From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
2 years after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, handing abortion decisions back to individual states, access advocates are speaking out.
I'm here to encourage every woman to take their power into their own hands, and they to get to dictate their own health care and what happens to their body.
Survivors of now-shuttered reform schools in Florida are celebrating a monumental effort to compensate them for the horrific abuse they suffered.
It brought relief to a lot of people that has lived with this their whole life.
And the governor's decision to eliminate local arts funding from the state budget sends the community reeling. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Lynn Hatter, in for Tom Flanagan. Welcome to tonight's show. A Florida law banning most abortions after 6 weeks has been in place for about 2 months now. Abortion access advocates say it's putting women in danger. Some doctors are hesitant to use an exception in the law that allows for care to save the life of the mother, and some pregnant people have been forced to travel out of state. Regan McCarthy reports earlier this week advocates used the anniversary of the fall of Roe v. Wade to encourage Floridians to take action.
Melissa Farmer traveled to 3 states to find a doctor who would perform the abortion she needed when her water broke just past 18 weeks of pregnancy. Recently, she traveled to one more state, Florida, where she hopes her story will urge residents to prioritize reproductive care in the upcoming elections.
I'm here to encourage every woman to take their power into their own hands, and they to get to dictate their own health care and what happens to their body.
Farmer says she'll always remember the day she told her husband Matt she was pregnant.
It was pure joy. It was just a moment that I'll never forget. He was so happy, and to see the look on his face when he found out, it'll just make me cry to think of that moment again. We sat up all night just talking about the future.
At 41, Farmer's pregnancy was considered high risk, but when she reached her second trimester, she thought she could breathe a sigh of relief. A day after her 18-week appointment, her water broke. She rushed to the hospital in Missouri, where she lived at the time, and was relieved to find her obstetrician was on call.
And she told us that there was no amniotic fluid left, and that her fetus would no longer survive. Additionally, with the amniotic fluid break, bacteria can get in there and an infection can happen pretty quickly. And I just said, what do I do? And she said, I recommend that you go out of the state to get your care.
Missouri law bans most abortions except in the case of medical emergencies. Farmer's doctor said she would need to get sicker before they could act. So Farmer drove 3 hours away to a hospital in Kansas. Abortion there is allowed up to 22 weeks, but Farmer happened to be there right around the time back in August of 2022 when voters in Kansas rejected a proposed state constitutional amendment that would have removed the right to abortion. Farmer says a doctor turned her away there, too, saying her medical emergency was too, quote, politically heated. Finally, Farmer says she found a clinic in Illinois that could help. Bleeding and in pain, she drove with her husband, Matt, the more than 5 hours to the clinic. Matt says he's still affected by the trauma today.
All I can do is sit there with my hands tied in despair while I watch her struggle mentally and physically and her condition decline.
Farmer believes the care she received in Illinois saved her life. She says restrictive laws and the chilling effect they caused are what put her life at risk. She's urging Floridians to keep that in mind when they head to the ballot box in November. Farmer was joined by other advocates like Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried, who says judicial appointments made by former President Donald Trump paved the way for Florida's 6-week abortion ban to take effect. And she worries Republicans could further restrict access to reproductive health care, including contraception and IVF.
And so we're going to continue holding Republicans accountable here in the state of Florida between Rick Scott and Donald Trump and obviously DeSantis. You know, we would not be in this moment if DeSantis didn't take the ball from Donald Trump after the Supreme Court decision, and he ran with it. And then the Republicans in the legislature spiked it, and now we're sitting in 6 weeks of abortion ban.
Florida Senator Rick Scott recently joined fellow Republicans in the U.S. Senate in voting against a bill that would have explicitly protected access to contraception. Scott calls the proposal stunt legislation. He says Democrats are pushing the issue in an attempt to scare voters into believing there's a threat to contraception access. And Donald Trump has touted the idea that the fall of Roe means individual states can make their own rules about abortion access. Meanwhile, on the state level, Governor Ron DeSantis has called a proposed state constitutional amendment that explicitly protects abortion access up to viability extreme. And House Speaker Paul Renner has pledged to fight against it. He says it's something people in the middle will disagree with.
But when you dig into this amendment, they would find it to be far, far more extreme than anything else really in the country and even around the world.
The proposed amendment says, in part, no law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's health care provider. It will need approval from 60% of voters to pass. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Survivors of two infamous and now closed reform schools in Florida are set to receive compensation for the abuse they suffered as children. Tristan Wood reports the move comes after more than a decade of advocacy from survivors. And this advisory, details in this story, may be disturbing to some listeners.
Hundreds of children who attended the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna and the Okeechobee School were mentally, physically, and sexually abused between 1940 and 1975. Dozens were killed. More than 50 unmarked graves were found at the sites. Charles Fudge is president of the official White House Boys Group. He says it's been a long time coming for him and other survivors.
Yeah, it's been 16 years when some of the boys got together and started speaking about it. And for a long time, no one actually believed what took place there.
Fudge got to the Dozier School in Marianna when he was 12. On his third day there, he says he was taken to a building called the White House, where he was beaten with a leather strap over 30 times with his face down in a dirty pillow.
And after that beating, our bottom sides was bleeding, black, blue, purple. Just how we endured that, only God can imagine.
The first domino for recognition of what happened came in 2011 when a federal investigation found there was reason to believe rampant abuse took place. The search for unmarked graves began in 2012 and remains were found in 2015. Former Governor Rick Scott issued an official apology on behalf of the state in 2017. Survivors have regularly showed up for years at the state capitol to advocate for themselves. This year, survivor Bryant Middleton talked about how children were sexually abused. He says employees would come to the dorm in the middle of the night and select boys to take to a separate building where they were raped and beaten.
Two three-state employees would come into the dormitory and walk back and forth between the beds. Suddenly you would hear a child scream out, "No, please, not me." They would grab that child by the arm and take him outside and put him in the car. And he would be gone for a couple of hours. And suddenly the gravel sound came back. They returned that child. The child was told, "Get in your bed." Often his pajamas were covered with blood.
One of the bill's sponsors, Democratic State Senator Daryl Roussan, said at the committee stop that no money could ever fairly compensate the men or the families of those who didn't survive the schools. Fudge was in attendance when Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill. He says it was an uplifting moment for him and other survivors that were present.
After seeing our governor sign that bill, it brought relief to a lot of people that has lived with this their whole life.
To him, the bill signing meant more than just the money. It was about making sure something like the Dozier School never happens again.
Our legacy is that no other institution, regardless of where they are, never takes and abuse children the way we were. You don't take and beat children like we were beat.
From this year's budget, $20 million is going to the compensation program. I'm Tristan Wood.
Nonprofit arts and cultural organizations expected to tap into $32 million in grants from the state starting next month. Not anymore. Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed that funding from the upcoming state budget, and now organizations statewide are scrambling to prevent staff layoffs, cuts to programs, or even shutting down altogether. Will Keene Brutus reports.
It's the first time anyone can remember that there was no money for arts organizations in the state budget.
In 2019, the grant program was cut down to about $2 million for the entire state, and that was one of our lowest funding for the grant program. But I don't think historically they have ever been cut down to zero.
Jennifer Sullivan is Senior Vice President at the Cultural Council for Palm Beach County.
It was definitely a surprise for us in the industry.
The state's Division of Arts and Culture usually issues money through four grant categories. One category typically helps organizations with things like salaries, utilities, and rent. Sullivan says organizations often use these critical state dollars to match individual contributions from private donors.
The other thing about these grants is they're a dollar-for-dollar match. So a lot of organizations will use their state dollars to leverage the private side to get that match. So if an organization was to, say, get $150,000 from the state, that actually has a $300,000 impact on the organization because they would have had to have matching dollars. And now they won't have those dollars to leverage with some of their donors and other funders.
And now big and small organizations are reeling from the cuts. A spokesman for Governor Ron DeSantis explained the cuts by saying it's in the state's best interest to reduce overall government spending. The $32 million DeSantis vetoed from arts programs was among nearly $1 billion in cuts overall. The total budget is about $116 billion. Arts leaders argue cutting funding for their organizations hurts Florida's economy. A national study from the advocacy group Americans for the Arts found that in Florida, arts and culture organizations generate nearly $6 billion a year in economic activity.
When people don't go to restaurants to eat out before a show because theaters had to cancel programming, or stay a few nights in a hotel because a museum had to change its days open because it couldn't support staffing. And this is ultimately taking away jobs from the tax-paying Florida artists.
Margaret Ledford is artistic director of the City Theater in Miami, which is known for short plays and mentorship programs for emerging playwrights. The theater's funding was cut by more than $40,000. Ledford says that's about 6% of their budget.
Governor removes things he doesn't like the term climate change in state statutes, or things he considers woke. And this is another one of those removals, which in the end will only hurt the state's tourist dollars.
The Florida Cultural Alliance, a statewide arts advocacy group, surveyed arts organizations across the state about the impact of their programming. More than 100 organizations responded. Jennifer Jones is president and CEO.
5% of the respondents are going to have to cease operations. That's important. It means they're going to go away. About 8% are going to have to cancel the expansion of a facility because of those facility grants that were vetoed. And 18% are going to have to cancel repairs to their facility. So that's about, 30% of the respondents are basically going to stop doing what they were going to do. The other 70-odd% are having to make adjustments, whether it's canceling programs for seniors or children, or reduce the staff, eliminate positions, or cancel public events. You know, they will do those things to make adjustments to make their budgets work without this funding.
That's the sound of a Latin jazz band performing at the Arts Garage in Delray Beach. It's a small venue with music, theater, and comedy shows. It was expecting more than $70,000 in state funding.
It's going to potentially impact the quality of our programming. It's going to impact the quantity of our programming.
Marjorie Waldo is president and CEO.
It's going to impact what we're able to do for our sister community organizations that we work together to provide opportunities. I think we gave out over 1,000 free tickets in the last year. We'll have to look at every dollar differently as a result of this.
One of those sister organizations is the Spady Cultural Heritage Museum in Delray Beach, a nonprofit museum preserving and sharing Black history for the past two decades. It suffered a cut of nearly $30,000. Charlene Farrington is executive director. She says the sudden removal of state funding feels like an existential threat towards the arts and culture community.
So yeah, this was very shocking. This, I never in my wildest dreams anticipated this. But the removal of funding indicates a removal of support. That's what that says to me, that we no longer think you are important, and therefore we're going to remove all support. If that is the thinking, then the state of Florida is in trouble.
Some organizations will be able to weather the financial storm with their reserves and strong donor community. Bonnie Clearwater is director and chief curator at Nova Southeastern University's Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale. She says after lessons from major economic downturns like that of the Great Recession and COVID pandemic, she's optimistic about bouncing back and plans to double down on marketing efforts.
One of the things that people learned from COVID was that because the staff base had been reduced, it became very hard to then fill those positions afterwards. We've invested so much in the development of our staff. They're creative. They're amazing. They will help find the solutions to our current situation.
Jennifer Jones from the Florida Cultural Alliance says arts and culture organizations plan to work more closely with state legislators and the governor's office.
We're going to have to engage, become friends with the person who thought it was the best interest of the state to totally wipe us out and come to some good understanding and appreciation for each other's position and hopes that it doesn't happen again. And it would demonstrate that we're good partners and that we really all have the best interests of Florida.
I'm Wilkin Brutus in Palm Beach County.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the U.S. Supreme Court says cities and counties can enforce bans on sleeping outside, and a new Florida law takes effect in October to do just that. Now advocates worry the state is criminalizing homelessness.
When I reached out to other local sheriff's agencies, Pasco County Sheriff's Office actually said, you know, homelessness is not a crime and that they only respond to criminal issues.
Floridians fed up with so-called nuisance black bears can now shoot if they feel threatened. But one researcher says it's all a misunderstanding.
I would never speak a human language, so over the 2.5 year period, I learned how to speak black bear and actually communicated with them in their language, which is how I learned how they communicate and how they talk.
And the state makes a forceful pushback on anti-Semitism with a new set of laws.
A number of Jewish schools around the state had been receiving death threats.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today cities can enforce bans on the unhoused population sleeping outside. The ruling comes as a Florida law goes into effect in October that blocks people from sleeping in public places. Homeless advocates say punishing people who need a place to sleep would criminalize homelessness. For the last 2 months, the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office has been tracking where the unhoused are sleeping. WMNF's Chris Young spoke with Tampa Bay Times reporter Justin Garcia about a list he received with homeless people's names and the agencies tracking them.
Once I had the list, it was titled, it was named after the law that Governor Ron DeSantis signed. And the list was essentially 3 pages and showed all these different locations around Pinellas County where they were monitoring where people are sleeping outside and how many people are there. And then I saw that it wasn't just Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, it was Gulfport Police Department, Pinellas Park Police Department, and Clearwater Police Department were also involved. But St. Petersburg Police Department chose not to get involved with the project. And then I found that none of the other sheriff's offices were getting involved either.
So what makes Pinellas County unique that they were the ones that decided to do this? And what were some of the hesitancies in the other sheriff's departments?
Well, I think Pinellas County Sheriff's Office was saying essentially they want to track where these people are so that way they can approach them with social workers and deputies and educate them and give them options is what they said in a statement to me. When I asked for more details about how they're educating people and how they're approaching them and what options they're giving them, they said we're not going to give any further comment. And then when I reached out to other local sheriff's agencies, Pasco County Sheriff's Office actually said, you know, homelessness is not a crime and that they only respond to criminal issues. Hillsborough Sheriff's Office said they did not have such a list. And Polk County Sheriff's Office also said they did not have a list. They didn't say exactly why they didn't have the list, but it seems like they weren't taking the same action ahead of time that Pinellas County Sheriff's Office is.
You mentioned that they declined to comment on how they're educating these individuals about the upcoming law. Why do you think there is reluctance there?
I can't speculate too much, but in my experience of working with law enforcement agencies, I think the public is always looking for transparency, right? If you are educating homeless people or people without a place to live on what to do, those details kind of help the public be more aware of what's going on out there. And so it definitely is one of those things where you get, when you get a no comment, when you ask a question, it just only raises more questions.
That was Tampa Bay Times reporter Justin Garcia speaking to WMNF's Chris Young. The Pinellas County Sheriff's Office declined a request for an interview, but did give a statement that says, quote, in order to have the outreach to the affected homeless population, we need to know where they are. Governor Ron DeSantis has just signed a controversial measure allowing people to kill bears on their property if they feel threatened. The law takes effect July 1st. But as Margie Menzel reports, a film being made in the Panhandle shows we have a lot to learn about the Florida black bear.
The footage is remarkable. Close-ups of a mother bear and her cub deep in their habitat, climbing, playing, even looking into the camera's eye. Eric Zales got those shots by living with bears in the Panhandle for 2.5 years. Before getting any footage, though, he had to learn how to be with them. His ground rules were never to do anything to harm them and never to do anything to alter their behavior.
I would never stand in front of them. I was always on all fours. I always had a ghillie suit on. If you don't know what that is, it's like if you see one of those Army movies and all of a sudden the bush stands up and it was actually a guy. So I always had a ghillie suit on. I would never speak a human language. So over the 2.5 year period, I learned how to speak black bear and actually communicated with them in their language, which is how I learned how they communicate and how they talk.
Zales is the director and co-founder of the Paper Bear Organization, which is making the film. It's also the film's name. Zales says he can't explain why or he'll be giving away too much about the film.
It centers around the Panhandle of Florida as a whole and the biodiversity hotspot that it is, which very few people in the country and specifically in Florida realize that the Panhandle of Florida is an incredibly important area of the country in terms of biodiversity. It's literally America's little Amazon.
And in the film, the story about the Panhandle is told through the eyes of a black bear. Florida had about 4,050 bears, according to a 2017 estimate by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, the most recent available data. The numbers had fallen to between 300 to 500 bears in the 1970s, but the species was able to rebound while listed by the state as threatened. Franklin County Sheriff A.J. Smith, who supports the new law, says that as the bear population has grown, more bears are living where humans do. And it's a problem.
We have bears in cars, we have bears in people's homes, we have bears on their porches, and we have bears come to the bus stop where kids are. I think we've had a couple of bears attack animals. We have not had, since I've been sheriff, an attack on a person. So we've had a lot of close calls.
Smith says Franklin is the third smallest county in Florida, and humans live on about 5% of it. The rest is national and state forest.
These bears are bred and they're born and bred in these areas, and they don't know any place else but the populated areas because that's where they were born and bred.
When the bear bill passed in the 2024 legislative session, Zales came to speak in committee and was troubled by what he heard.
They were saying the bear did this and the bear did that. And in my mind, I'm going, oh my gosh, all the things you're describing are the opposite of what you're thinking. That's actually the bear telling you it's not going to hurt you. And then when they said the bear did this and it was fine, I'm like, no, that means the bear is actually not fine. If it gets really eerily quiet and turns its head sideways, that's when everybody's like, oh, it's fine. And that's more of a sign that it's, you know, potentially feeling threatened. And
Zales says black bears are shy and that they can smell a ripe berry a mile away, which may explain why they get in people's garbage cans.
If as a culture and as a society, we decide that we're going to protect a species, then as a culture and as a society, it is our responsibility to educate on how to live with that species again, because there's a reason that species was almost wiped out. And it's usually because humans didn't like what they were doing or misunderstood.
Salas expects the film will be shown early next year. He hopes at a major film festival. I'm Margie Menzel.
You're listening to Capitol Report. Finally tonight, Florida is making efforts to combat anti-Semitism. The governor signed bills into law implementing more school security for Jewish day schools and revising the state's definition on anti-Semitism. Adrian Andrews has more on the legislation.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed two bills addressing anti-Semitism. The first gives Jewish day schools in Florida recurring state funding for security measures like installing cameras, fencing, and shatter-resistant glass. The governor says the legislation comes amid a rise in anti-Semitic activities on school campuses since the October 7 Hamas attack in Israel.
You have a lot of elite colleges and universities that have allowed themselves to become overrun with encampments, graffiti, as well as a lot of really nasty anti-Semitism.
Under the provision, Jewish day schools in Florida will be given $20 million to bolster their security. This is on top of the $25 million, which the Florida legislature approved as part of last year's state budget to safeguard Jewish day campuses. DeSantis has tapped the state's education department to distribute the money to 134 Jewish schools across the state.
A number of Jewish schools around the state had been receiving death threats, and parents were pulling their kids out of those schools.
That's State Republican Representative Randy Fine. He represents Brevard County and the surrounding area. He's also the bill's sponsor. Additional provisions in his bill allows Jewish day schools to hire their own licensed and insured security team. Representative Vicky Lopez of Miami says this would ensure the children and families of her district are kept safe.
They have suffered greatly violence against their property, against their people. They have a daycare. It has been a very difficult time.
The second bill the governor signed revises the state's definition for anti-Semitism to include any physical and verbal attacks against Jews. The language is taken from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which was created to promote Holocaust education. Davie Democratic Representative Michael Gottlieb is one of many state lawmakers supporting the measure.
Jews continue to bear the brunt of 60% of all religious hatred, despite being a population of 2.4%.
Religious leaders across Florida have been showing their support for the Jewish community. Rabbi Paul Sitolovsky leads the Jewish temple in Tallahassee. In an interview at WFSU, he thanked local and state leaders for helping support the cause.
We feel certainly a connection with Israel, as Jews all over the world do, but it is really gratifying to see people of all different backgrounds and faiths come together to show support.
Both laws take effect July 1st. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Taylor Cox produced this episode, and I'm Len Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.